Kaya Wanju, hello, welcome to another episode of The Curb. I'm Andrew Pierce, and this is a podcast where I bring you in-depth interviews with filmmakers, creatives, and curators of culture. This podcast is recorded in Boorloo, Western Australia, sovereignty never ceded. Genevieve Bailey is a documentarian who has drawn attention to the impact of societal struggles with mental illness through her empathetic and nurturing body of work. With feature films like I Am 11 and Happy Sad Man, Jen embraces a supportive mindset, using the power of cinema to bring real-life stories to audiences. It's that sense of support that is keenly felt in her latest documentary, Always Listening, a short film about the history of Lifeline Australia. Jen takes us to the end of the telephone where we meet the counsellors and support people who volunteer their time, emotions and empathetic listening skills to guide people through mental health crisis events, suicidal ideation and other critical mental struggles. Like Jen's previous film, Happy Sad Man, Always Listening is a beautiful and moving experience, opening audiences up to the power of understanding emotion and empathy, while also guiding people who live with their own mental health struggles to understand that there is help available and that there are people there to support you through your most difficult moments. It's these two mindsets, the support and the supported, that has changed how I navigate my interviews and film coverage, leading me to ask questions that are focused around the emotion of a film rather than the creative process of how it was made. That is important, but in my mind, of course, why we sit down and watch films, why we experience TV, why we engage with art, is for an emotional experience, for an emotional reaction. I like to keep that in mind when I talk to people, and I kept that in mind when I first saw Happy Sad Man back in 2019 as well. And I was fortunate enough to also host a couple of Q&A sessions here in Perth for that event. At that time, I was going through my own personal mental health struggles. And yet, while I knew that Lifeline existed, I also didn't feel like I was able to call the service. At the time, I felt like my pain and struggle wasn't significant enough for me to pick up the phone and talk through the problems I was experiencing. Over time, my mindset has thankfully changed, and through watching a film like Always Listening, I'm further reminded that services like Lifeline and Beyond Blue are here for your support and to help guide you through those dark moments. I'm in a better place now and don't need to call Lifeline, but I'm glad that it still exists. And, you know, through my current work and career and the experiences that I've had, I've also really shifted towards a supportive mindset myself, and have done mental health first aid training, which is something I highly recommend if you have the time or capacity to do, that you do it for yourself and for your colleagues and for your family as well. It's really, really helpful, and it's helped me understand and shift my perspective on what it means to be a supportive person and an empathetic person as well. And that mindset shift comes from getting to see who the people are on the other end of the line in a documentary like Always Listening. These are everyday folks who have sometimes been through their own mental health crisis, or live with their own struggles, or they simply know what it's like to be in a place of need and are able to support those who need it most. These are gentle, genuine folks who are caring, engaged, and understand the complexity of the weight of the mental health crisis in Australia, and by extension, that the world faces as well. Again, that's a notion that underpins how Genevieve Bailey embraces her work as a documentarian, telling stories that matter about people that care. I'm grateful to have been able to talk with Jen about Always Listening, and on multiple occasions about her work. I've always appreciated the time she's given me to be able to talk about films like Happy Sad Man, like Always Listening, or even being able to stand in front of an audience of people who are moved by the films that she's created, and standing there listening to how her words impact an audience. She's a very nurturing and kind and supportive documentarian. And I'm really lucky and grateful that I'm able to share with you her stories, including the impact that her films have had on audiences around the world. Always Listening is screening on SBS On Demand right now. It's only 30 minutes long, but it will leave a mark. And if you or someone you love is going through a mental health crisis, Lifeline Australia is available 24/7 on 13 11 14. Or alternatively, visit lifeline.org.au. Usually, this would be the point that you give a trigger warning or anything like that for the discussion. But mental health crisis and support is something that we all need to listen to and engage with and understand a little bit more. So while there are some trigger points in this particular discussion, I also really encourage you to just sit back, listen to what Jen has to say, and then also check out her movies as well. Always Listening is beautiful. Again, it's on SBS On Demand right now. It's really beautiful stuff. Right. If you want to find out more about what we do on The Curb, this is the sell moment about what the website is about. Australian films, reviews, culture, all that kind of stuff. Then head over to thecurb.com.au. Or you can follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and Blue Sky at thecurb.au. We are also a completely independent ad-free website that lives on support of listeners and readers just like yourself. So if you have the capacity and the ability to, we would really appreciate it if you could head over to patreon.com/thecurb.au and support us from as little as $1 a month. And look, if you're unable to financially support us, that is okay. Please consider sharing this interview with your film-loving friends. And if you could also head over to your podcast catcher or player of choice, Apple would be wonderful. Leave us a rate and review on there. Every review helps amplify the interviews and the stories from filmmakers to a wider audience. That's what I love doing, is being able to share these stories with you, a listener. It means a lot. Right, it's enough of me monologuing. I hope that you enjoy this particular conversation with Jen Bailey. Here is the trailer for Always Listening. Again, SBS On Demand right now. Give it a watch.
Hi. What is happening for you today?
I've always admired what they've done, what they stand for, but the idea of talking on the phone terrified me.
It just changed my whole course. And my family and friends have seen the change in me.
We come from all different backgrounds. Hence, some people bring a particular skill and others have just built on training and become the person they need to be.
Yarn is a term that we use to chat. And it's a really welcoming word, you know. You can ring up and have a yarn with somebody.
Crisis means something different to different people.
Throw out the lifeline, throw out the lifeline.
Yeah.
Someone is slipping away.
Did you do a fair bit of hugging?
I did a fair bit of hugging. I was about to say that before.
We did have these magnificent phrases almost from the Victorian era that people would use about Auntie so-and-so's got bad nerves, you know, terrible nerves, which I'm sure meant they had depression or anxiety.
Personally, for me, it made me safe and got me home to my family at my lowest point.
I remember saying, I don't know where to start, and she said, you don't have to start, just tell me how you are.
Let's start talking about Always Listening. Like, it's a powerful short film, but how did it come about? How did your engagement with Lifeline and telling the history of Lifeline in this way come about?
Yeah, well, I had been screening Happy Sad Man, which, you know, many, many times around Australia, and in lots of occasions I was able to travel to the screenings for Q&As and to meet audiences. And every now and then I would have a screening around Australia and someone would come up to me and say that they volunteer with Lifeline. And I was in touch with Lifeline about hosting screenings of the film for their crisis supporters. So we were doing that, quite a few of them during COVID actually. So online with Zoom Q&A sessions at the end. And Lifeline basically got in touch with me, and someone there had heard about my work and said, would you be interested in making a film, a documentary about the history of Lifeline? And I straight away thought, like, I'm so familiar with Lifeline, and many of us are. We hear you know, you hear the number, the website, that it's available 24/7, that it's anonymous, that people can reach out. But I thought to myself, who are the actual people who answer these calls? Like, I feel like I've never seen a face of one of them. I've never seen an interview with them that I can think of. And I thought to myself straight away, yeah, I want to make this film. So, yeah, then began to learn a lot about the history of Lifeline and its origins and who founded it and where and why. And that interest in who's answering those calls was very strong for me. So being able to travel and meet crisis supporters was, yeah, a big highlight for me with this production.
And it complements Happy Sad Man in such a beautiful way as well, where in some capacity you're acting as a counsellor, as a therapist, as support for the men that are in that film by being able to share their story and being a confidant and being a person to be able to, for them to, you know, talk about what they're going through. And I guess, you know, that was what, 2018 that came out?
Yeah.
What's that now? Oh gosh, you know, 5-7 years now. No, that can't be right. Yeah. that's crazy.
I know.
The impact of that film, like, it's still going. You're still holding screenings. It still means something to people. What does that mean to you to be able to carry that on and be able to continue sharing that story with audiences?
Oh, it means so much to me. I think I always have said that my films aren't really finished until they're received by people, by audiences. And I know some filmmakers make films and they will say, this film is for me. I'm not making it for other people. It's for me. But for me personally, my films are so much for other people. They're not just kind of something I want to get off my chest. There's something I want to share. There's stories I want to amplify and there's impact that I want to help kind of ignite with community. And I think for me, knowing that my films are still screening after many years, so Happy Sad Man came out, yeah, in festivals in 2018 and then in cinemas in 2019. And my first documentary, I'm 11, was first screened in 2011. And I just confirmed a screening in the US this morning. So it's like 14 years later. So yeah, I don't rush things, but I also I spend a long time on the distribution side of things. And it's great to know that the films are evergreen, so to speak, and they're still reaching audiences. And I hope that Always Listening will be the same.
Yeah, I'm certain it will be. With that in mind, one of the aspects which I really appreciated about Happy Sad Man was the audience interaction afterwards and people saying, I saw Happy Sad Man and I felt this. Are there any kind of major anecdotes or experiences with that, like the post-screening interaction that lingers with you as saying, like, yes, I've done the right thing. This is why I've done the right thing with making this film.
Oh, so many. There's so many, Andrew. Really touching moments, really funny moments, really unexpected moments. One guy came up to me after a screening at Cinema Nova in Melbourne and he was queuing for quite a long time to have a chat and I could see him in the corner of my eye and, yeah, I didn't want to rush conversations, but I was mindful that he seemed to have been waiting for a long time. And when I spoke to him, he actually explained that he wanted to, you know, share what he thought about the film and his feedback was extremely touching and memorable. But he also wanted to ask, he held up the flyer for the film and he pointed at it and he wanted to ask, would it be okay if I got a tattoo of your film poster on me? And I was like, wow, this is the first time for me. So, yeah, there's so many moments where people of all ages, one older man in Brisbane came up to me and said, I loved the movie. He was very colourful, was wearing these amazing colourful pants. And he said, I love the story. Thank you so much for the film. I've tried to kill myself twice this year. And the second time what stopped me was thinking about all my loved ones around my bed, thinking if only Grandpa thought, you know, he was enough. So thanks for the movie. And people, you know, leave the cinema. And I'm so profoundly impacted by these statements people share. And I could name many, many more, but it's just been really touching to know that impact, that in 93 minutes someone can hear a story or an experience or a moment or a feeling that resonates with them and you know, encourages them to remember they're not the only one going through it and that their feelings are really valid. So that in itself has been amazing, but there's been so many other impactful moments thanks to the guys in the film who were so generous to share their story with me.
part of the reason why I'm focusing so much on that is that it feels like your role as a counsellor, again, that word feels apt to explore and always listening. But have you ever thought to be a counsellor? Have you ever done any counselling at all?
No, I remember someone from Mental Health First Aid approached me after seeing the film and sort of just presumed that I'm a mental health first aider. And I said, no, to be honest, I feel a bit embarrassed to say I've never heard of it. And then I became aware of this organisation and all the mental health first aiders around Australia who are trained and doing this work. And because they said that from what they heard of my approach in the film, of what they hear me talking about, it's very aligned with their course. So in short, I haven't done any training around it, but I just feel like life has been my training ground, and my friendship with John from Happy Sad Man in particular encouraged me to be curious and inquire and be open about having conversations around mental health and mental illness, because it certainly wasn't something that I didn't grow up in a home where those sort of conversations were encouraged or facilitated at all. So yeah, it was very much my own motivation to see things differently and to hope that other people feel comfortable talking to me as well.
I mean, I should note as well, like, it's been 25 years since Mental Health First Aid was founded, and it was Australian. They recently just held an event which I went to and was fantastic. And it's curious, when I did my Mental Health First Aid certificate, I did think about Happy Sad Man quite a bit, because it's like, oh, there's so much of this foundational stuff. And I mean, being the person I am, I always bring it back to films, because why not? But there was that aspect of knowing, oh, right, whether you're conscious of it or not, like, it is there, right? And that's part of what being a mental health first aid person is not about applying first aid as such, like in the traditional sense, but it's about providing support. And that's a huge aspect of who you are as a filmmaker. That notion of support as a director and as a storyteller is really core to who you are, well, at least how I feel from your work. Is that something you feel, or is like went into filmmaking with wanting to be somebody who supported these kinds of stories?
Yeah, definitely. And I think that for me, some of my proudest moments are when people either in the film say how happy they are with seeing themselves, even though they're surprised. Like, a lot of people cringe, you know, myself included, when you see yourself on camera. But when the people in my films are proud of their representation, or if people who know them or even don't know them say, oh, they look so comfortable, how did you make them so comfortable? For me, that's one of my proudest moments, because that's what I want. I want people to feel themselves. And I know that if I'm being interviewed or photographed that I'm not comfortable, I look a bit different, I sound a bit different, and I think, oh, I mustn't have yet been quite kind of in the pocket of comfort. So I think in a way, for me, knowing that people involved in my films are 100% consenting to the experience and enjoying it, hopefully, you know, I really want people to feel that sharing their story is something that can be playful. Like, even though we're talking about serious themes, I want the people involved to have fun and to feel that I'm approachable and that they can chat with me. If something they've said they don't want to be disclosed on camera, that's fine. So it's very collaborative in that way. Yeah, definitely.
Which then makes sense with Always Listening, where we're getting to learn who the people are on the other end of a Lifeline phone. And most of the time as a counsellor, like, you're not usually, certainly a Lifeline counsellor, you're not being somebody who's visibly there, right? And so you're relying solely on your voice and the emotions. And of course, it go into other forms of support there as well, the texting support and things like that. But specifically focusing on the voice support, I'm curious about what you discovered as you were shooting it and getting to meet these particular counsellors about how they posed themselves on the phone, like, you know, just sitting there listening to people and providing support, how they actually provided that support on a verbal manner.
Yeah, well, I've always been really interested in voice and voices, and obviously being a filmmaker, music is always a big part of my process with Nick Huggins, my amazing composer. But voices are so... well, they're amazing in what they can contribute to a film and the audio landscape. But I know that when I made I'm 11, I was very strict with myself that I didn't want my voice to be in the film. So when I'm interviewing these children around the world, I would ask them to answer in a full sentence. So instead of saying Berlin, please say I live in Berlin, because I'm not going to use my voice. And I was always saying to the kids, I'm not going to have my voice in it. And then when I was editing the film and editing Billy in particular, who's the British boy and definitely became an audience favourite, I would be laughing because he would be so hilarious and I could hear myself laughing, and I don't like the sound of my own voice. So I was thinking, oh, we're going to have to cut that out in post. Oh, we're going to have to cut that out. But in the edit, I realised I can't just keep cutting out my voice. So I'm having a conversation with these people. It's actually weird if I keep trying to cut it out. So just on that point, I think I realised with voice, sometimes you just got to go with it, even if you don't like the sound of your own voice. But what I think is interesting about being a documentary filmmaker and working the way I do is you can sit, much like what you do in your work, Andrew, and listen to people talking for really long periods of time. And I try not to make noises like, So if you're interviewing someone and they can see you and you're not doing any reactions, sometimes that can feel unnatural for them, because if they're telling you a story and you're just nodding, they don't realize why you're not going, oh, yeah, right, oh, amazing, oh, that must have been intense, oh, wow, when was that? So I just try and do really expressive faces and nod and smile. But every now and then it just doesn't work. You have to say something. So I was very interested with the Lifeline crisis supporters, as you say, because they can't see them, how they have been trained, because they all do training, to acknowledge what someone's saying without there's all sorts of things they don't want to do, for example, try and solve a problem or tell them that their, you know, attitude isn't, you know, right, or say things like, oh, no, that can't be happening, oh, no, like, you know, using words like that. But as humans, we just naturally try and fill in the silent spaces sometimes. And I think that's what was amazing about the Lifeline crisis supporters, is they're truly actively listening. And we talked in the film with some of the participants about what that actually means to actively listen, and not listen to solve a problem or listen to respond. But active listening is something that the crisis supporter said to me, it's not a natural thing for some people. Like, it's not a, like, it can be a really learnt skill. We all have the capacity to learn it. So I was really fascinated to hear how they work, and how they, yeah, how they respond and be there without without talking that much sometimes.
And it's really hard, like, as you're saying, active listening is a real skill, but then also decentralizing yourself from the conversation too, because the focus is not you, right? And it's really bizarre. Like, I was talking to somebody the other day about doing interviews, just like we're doing right now, and how, like, I have my screen with the Zoom, there's your video, there's my video, and there is this almost very strange out-of-body experience that I have, where I have to remind myself that I'm actually the person asking the questions, because it feels like sometimes I'm watching a video and I'm like, oh, that person's asking something interesting, they're giving an interesting answer, forgetting that it's me actually doing the questioning. It's a bizarre thing, but I've gotten to that point because I've gotten to that ability, even though I'm now talking about myself, very strange meta moment. But anyway, because you are detaching yourself from the conversation, right? You're not the point of the conversation. And usually a conversation is about trying to, like, say, well, I felt this. Oh, you felt that? That's interesting, right? Whereas counseling is so much about actively providing support, and it's not about you. You're in fact actually trying to anonymize yourself as much as possible, trying to not give as much information, even though the person on the other end of the line is being so vulnerable and asking for help. And that's what I found really, really fascinating, is getting to hear the counselors talk about that relationship that they have with somebody they will never get to see. Can you possibly expand on that notion of providing help, but really the other person doesn't know who the other person is?
Yeah, for sure. I think that what attracts a lot of people to calling Lifeline is that the fact that it's anonymous. And I think that there's definitely regular callers. I learnt some of the Lifeline staff, so we do have some people who call frequently. And for a lot of people, they're calling and perhaps the person on the end of the phone is the only person they've spoken to that day or that week. So loneliness is a huge issue in Australia and around the world. So at a time where apparently more able to be connected than ever, actually a lot of people are feeling really lonely. So some of those people might be calling with an issue that perhaps other people don't consider a major crisis, whereas it's a spectrum. Some people might be calling when their life is actually imminently at risk. Some people might be calling because they call regularly when they're going through financial crisis, or perhaps a marriage is ending or someone's lost the job. So I think that's what I learned, is that when the crisis supporters listen, they learn that crisis is different for everyone. And so they have to respond in different ways. But the main thing is to make sure people are safe, obviously, if they need to get any support out there in person, but also just to know that they're heard and it's non-judgmental, that the conversation is really open and accepting of whatever someone's reality might be in that moment.
What I also really admired is that obviously this is in collaboration with Lifeline, but it doesn't feel like a marketing piece at all, right? Or anything like that, which I hope sounds like a compliment, because I'm trying to make it sound like a compliment. But there is a balance in making that kind of, you're working with somebody to tell their story, but you're not promoting or selling their story. How do you strike that balance? How do you make sure that you've got your own kind of authorial tone over the film?
Yeah, I think, well, first of all, Lifeline had seen my work and understood my motivation to share people's stories in an authentic way. So I wasn't interested in making a corporate video piece, for example. They're different. There's a role for them, but this was always going to be a creative storytelling experience where I get to know and get to learn about an organization, but mainly about its people and its impact. So there's so many Lifeline volunteers, past and present, and there will be in the future. So I knew I couldn't include everyone, but I wanted to travel a little bit around Australia to see a cross-section of who these people are. Because like I mentioned before, I feel like I've never seen them. I don't know what they look like. I don't know what their story is. I don't know. Are they all psychologists? Are they retired psychologists? I didn't know. And they're definitely not. That's what I learned, is that they are a really diverse bunch of people. So we had Michelle, who was a dairy farmer from up near Coffs Harbour, who I loved that she explained that she's not good on the phone at the best of times. Like, she's someone who just doesn't want to be on the phone, even if it's a socially. She prefers to message. So she always knew about Lifeline, but never kind of put a hand up to volunteer because she didn't think she could do the phones. And then when she heard that there was a text support available, she signed up for that. So she would do the night shift answering those texts from a little shed on her farm, and then get up and milk the cows in the morning, or go straight from that, you know, role. I just really admired that she found the time to do that as a volunteer, unpaid, when she already has a very full life. So that was a really, amazing experience, just hearing from someone who doesn't like talking on the phone, who's volunteering with Lifeline. I thought that was really cool, because a lot of people don't like talking on the phone these days. I like talking on the phone, but I know some people prefer to text. And I think it's really important that Lifeline has acknowledged that and brought in a text service, because I think when they were doing the trials for it, they said maybe even 40% or more of people who were using the text service said they would never have called. It was a really interesting experience as a filmmaker to learn how people like communicating and how some people perhaps would preference one over the other. And then to meet Ken, who was a volunteer who started 41 years ago. It's pretty amazing to think he started volunteering after going through a divorce and just never left, and is still there driving like over 2.5 hours each way for his shift as an unpaid volunteer. So yeah, these are the stories that I think, for me personally, what we hear about on the news and in the media and on TV, yeah, a lot of it's important to know about, but there's all this stuff that I'm like, why do we know about this? Why are we hearing this? Whereas I think hearing some of these stories from these people and these Australians as committed to caring for others is that's stories that I want to share.
I mean, you're talking really about selflessness, right? And there is a selflessness in being able to dedicate your time to telling their stories, but that's a core of what a volunteer is, right? A volunteer is a selfless act in itself. And there's, for want of a better term, there's nothing sexy about selflessness. And that's the really disappointing and distressing thing, because it's like, we should be hearing their stories. We should be hearing the stories of people who are volunteering and doing the part and keeping, 40 years of helping people listen to their problems and saving lives is phenomenal. It just astounds me that we don't really have more of those kinds of conversations or share more of those stories. So hopefully people are inspired to be able to do that from this work. But at the very least, you've done that here, which is important.
Yeah, I feel we really need it more and more. I just think a lot of people are feeling disheartened and discouraged, understandably, by what's going on in the world today, and we can't ignore the realities of the, you know, the wars and the conflict and the trauma and what's happening to our people and our planet. But I actually think to motivate people to know they can have a considerable impact in their own lives and other people's lives in a positive way is really important as well, so people don't feel so disempowered to make a difference.
With that in mind, it's been on SBS for a bit now. What's the reaction? Yeah. What's the response? Have you heard much about people who've responded to the film?
Yeah, it's been great. It is so different for me to have a film premiere on broadcast on SBS, because I'm so used to having my film screen in festivals and then in cinemas and travel around and meet people like yourself and be in a room together. So it was really different. I have had another documentary broadcast premiere on ABC before, where obviously I wasn't in the same room. We had some sort of cast and crew screenings and things like that. But yeah, it's great to have it available and know people can watch it 24/7 anytime they want and can find it through SBS On Demand as well. So yeah, I've received messages and emails, and when we were doing radio interviews and things like that, people sending in emails having heard us on the radio and sharing their stories, sometimes really sad stories, but also people feeling really buoyed about the documentary and the stories it can convey.
I mean, that kind of leads into one of the big things, which I think we talked about last time, and I think I talked about it even the first time that I spoke to you, which is about your mental health, right? And being able to make sure that you're kept safe when you're becoming the vessel for these stories and you're hosting screenings, you've got people coming up to you after, you know, telling you about taking their own lives and things like that. They're heavy things to deal with. How do you keep yourself safe?
It's interesting. Before Happy Sad Man came out, my composer, Nick, said to me, I'm really worried, because like the tour was about to begin. He's like, I'm just worried that you're just going to hear like all these trauma stories every night, every day. And there was a part of me that thought, oh yeah, that is going to be potentially quite intense. And even though it was intense at times, I think because people are chatting with me in the context of having just watched the film, and because the film is full of challenging moments, but ultimately full of a lot of hope, it wasn't, how do I put this? It wasn't as challenging as it could have been, in a way that I didn't feel like it was a detrimental part of my experience. But it was, yeah, it was at times really tough. And so, yeah, unfortunately, so many people in Australia and around the world have been touched by suicide or mental ill health or losing someone or nearly losing someone. So it's very common that someone has a personal story that they want to share. So, yeah, I have to kind of, yeah, acknowledge that it's kind of a load to carry that I, you know, have signed up for, because I believe that, yeah, stories, they do need to be shared and people do need to feel heard.
Yeah. But it's important and it's valued. it means a lot. Like, it's huge that somebody is having the foresight to be able to go, there's a crisis that's happening, let's shine a light on it and let's listen to the people who are in the midst of the crisis. And again, it comes back to the selflessness. It's huge. Like, it's so generous, I guess, is the best way of putting it. Do you feel that at all? Do you feel that sense of generosity as a filmmaker?
I just feel like a sense of necessity, like it needs to happen. Like, I feel like I used to make a lot of fiction films, like drama and comedy and experimental works, and I did love doing that. And it's not to say I won't ever make fiction again, but I feel like other people's true experiences are so compelling to me and so important that I feel this necessity to share them with the world. So for me, even though I know it might be hard sometimes, and as you say, there's lots of elements that might be perceived as not very sexy about these themes, I actually, because I can see the impact they have and because people are generous with sharing their reflections, I can really see the impact as being something that's critical to why I continue to make films.
Yeah. That's huge. Like, it means a lot. Like, and I know I keep on saying that, but it is vitally important. It's what I've enjoyed about being able to do the work that I do outside of this, which is, you know, it's not that exciting, but it's working in an organization which is values led, right? And it's values driven. And I know that when I go into work every day, that what I'm doing is helping the people of Western Australia with mental health crises and things like that. Whether it's conscious or unconscious, I'm not sure, but it's just something that, again, it's values driven work. And that's huge, where not every filmmaker needs to do that, have values driven work, but it's comforting knowing that you're out there doing it, right? Having the values driven work out there and being able to go, this is important. I'm going to dedicate time and energy, again, like 8 years of being able to tour it around different films, 14 years for I Am 11, like that's massive, you know, and it's still having an impact. It's like, yeah, it means a lot to me, yeah. So it must mean a lot to you, which is good.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, it does. And especially I love that I live in an age where people can, like, reach out and email me, like, who don't know me, because obviously back in the day that wasn't, people could write letters and try and find your postal address. But I've received some really amazing emails over the years, including one from a guy who lives in WA who saw Happy Sad Man on an aeroplane and then wrote, and then sometime later sought some help for his own mental health and found huge improvements in his life and some very eye-opening information about his own health. And I received an amazing email from a dad who hadn't even seen my film, but his daughter had seen I'm 11. And then what unfolded was like one of the most unforgettable email threads of my life. It was just so, I was so emotional. He was from Ohio in the US, and his daughter had seen the film. And long story short, their relationship had somewhat deteriorated in the recent years, that he had been unwell and received a health diagnosis that caused him to have like limited mobility and some seizures and things like that. And his daughter essentially became embarrassed by being seen with him in public, which was really heartbreaking for him. But once she saw I'm 11, she got up on stage and asked a Q&A, and I was in bed in Melbourne on Zoom trying to look like I wasn't in my pajamas doing the Q&A. And I could have just said, I can't do a Q&A at 3 a.m, but I said yes. And anyway, long story short, this dad said ever since she was at that screening, something had changed and I didn't know what. And I spoke to my wife and she explained the answer that you shared on stage. And that's now really impacted our relationship, because I explained that when I was 11, I didn't know that in 11 years my dad was going to pass away. And so I really value that I had that time with him when I was 11. So this girl then took it upon herself to spend more time with her father, who was unwell. And he wrote to me saying they've started this little project where she collects toothbrushes and food and clothes and blankets, and then gets in his ute and they drive around the city looking for homeless people to gift these boxes to. And then he wrote to me like a year or two later and said they're still doing it together and his health is getting better. And I was like, oh my gosh, I was like so emotional to think not only that it was happening, but that they had the capacity to find me and share that impact, because it was really, yeah, very special.
I think as a kind of lead into wrapping up, one of the things which I think is vitally important, we've kind of talked about this already, is that longevity of films. And so often, you know, I talk to filmmakers and they have, you know, an impact campaign and all this strategy and all this kind of stuff, and they're going to do it 90 minutes and then it's going to be a 60 minute and then all this kind of stuff, and is maybe only last for 18 months whatsoever and then move on to the next project. But as we've seen, like I'm 11, Happy Sad Man, you know, Always Listening, these are films that have longevity because they still have impact. But more importantly, you're making yourself available for them, right? And you're making yourself available for the stories that are in the films. And was there ever like this conscious realization that you needed to push against the filmmaking scene where there is like an 18-month tail end for a film and then you move on to something else, to make sure that you honoured the stories that you're being able to put on screen?
Yeah, I mean, essentially, I'd always hoped that I could reach broad audiences. You know, you can sound really naive as a filmmaker if you think you've really got a broad, diverse audience. But I was like, no, we will, and I'll work to make sure we reach them. Because I was very, very determined, and I always say 50% is making the film, 50% of my job is to make sure people see the film. So that's always been a big value for me, is to make sure, yeah, people experience the films, you know, and are able to enjoy a dialogue around them. But yeah, I definitely think, I remember years ago, a friend of mine's partner said, he described my work as like the opposite of fast fashion, like in terms of like stuff that's made very quickly and, you know, chewed up and spat out and not worn again. And I was like, yeah, sure. I think that's probably true because like I'm a pretty patient person and I'm okay with things taking a long time to make and also very okay with them taking time to reach people as well. So yeah, in answer to your question, I do make myself available sometimes at 3 a.m. And yeah, I don't regret that. I'm committed to it. Yeah,
it's good. It's comforting. With that in mind, like that interaction of knowing where to put the film, what audiences to interact with, what you know, cinemas to put it into, festivals, etc., etc. That must take a lot of work, and I'm sure you've got, you know, other people who might say, "Hey, suggest this and stuff." But knowing where to put the film and how to interact it with certain places, yeah, how do you do that? Like, what's your strategy? Do you like look at a map and go, "Where might be a place that would suit this?"
Yeah, I mean, sometimes we've got places we've played at before and we go back to them again. Sometimes we look at new areas. Like with Happy Sad Man, we specifically took the film out on the road to bushfire-affected towns and places that probably typically no filmmakers would go and take their film to reach people who perhaps could benefit from these conversations around mental health. But to be honest, I'll screen anywhere. And I shared this story with a friend recently that I know DVDs are not so much of a thing now and people are releasing, but when I'm 11 came out and we were releasing the DVD, Proud Mother Pictures is the name of my company. And we are, you know, very proud of what we make. And it was quite funny because we were putting up posters with like a sticky tape gun around the streets of Melbourne announcing the theatrical release. And we ran out of sticky tape and we went to a hardware store. Actually, we were announcing the DVD in iTunes release. And we ran out of sticky tape, went to a hardware store. And I thought to myself, a lot of people come into the hardware store, particularly lots of people working in a trade who are busy, and it's Mother's Day in a couple of weeks. So maybe we could sell the DVD at the front of the hardware store. Very unconventional. So I approached the guy at the hardware store. He said, "Speak to Mum. She's at the front." I spoke to her and she was like, "Well, we don't really sell DVDs." I'm like, "That's okay. That's fine if you don't sell them. Would you be interested in taking some? And if they don't sell, that's fine. I'll just take them back." So there's no risk to them. So we made a little counter display and they rang us a couple of days later and said, "We've sold out. Can we get some more DVDs?" And I thought, it's all about having a little piece of paper with my handwriting that says Mother's Day is coming up, you know, and then, you know, DVD $29 or whatever it was. And it was great because I just thought, yeah, people who are really busy but going to Harbour Store every day, they want to get something for their mum, put it there, and they can, you know. So that was a really fun kind of triumph. It was just like, in answer to your question, putting things in places that people might not suspect them to be, which is keeps things interesting.
Yeah, it's huge. Last question, which I know I've asked you this before, but it's about being an Australian filmmaker, and maybe your perspective might have changed over the years, but what it means to be able to put Australian stories and voices on screen. And I guess specifically, like, thinking of Always Listening, which is such a fundamental, like, lifeline has become such a core part of how we live our lives. It is there for us to be able to lean on and as support. Spotlighting that on screen has got to mean a lot. So yeah, what does it mean to be an Australian filmmaker telling Australian stories on screen?
Yeah, well, I feel like being an Australian filmmaker, not only do I want Australians to see my work, but I want people overseas to see my work as well, because I feel that obviously some people internationally only see a very narrow scope of Australian cinema, if any at all, and see a very narrow scope of what it is to be an Australian, or what we look like or sound like or what we do with our lives. So for me, I'm really proud of making films here that can travel, that people can see, and they can gain a better insight into how diverse our culture is, how diverse and multicultural Australians are, and also share what our, you know, our values are. And I think Lifeline was founded here and is over 60 years old now, but Lifeline International is in many different places. And I think that capacity for Australians to be known as larrikins and like easygoing, we live in a lucky country, but also actually we have really tragic rates of mental health. We have really, really difficult services to access. They are often, there's huge waiting lists, as you would know, there's often like a huge barrier in terms of costs for people to get support. So whilst I can't claim that I can magically cure those challenges, I think that actually spotlighting stories, for example, around mental health and individuals' journeys, as well as organisations like Lifeline, can remind Australians that actually we really like need to be there for people. And that's a big motivation for me as a filmmaker, is to say, we actually need to learn how to be there for people. If it doesn't come naturally for us, like work it out. You know what I mean? Like work out how to not only be there for other people, but be there for ourselves. And I think in half an hour or in an hour and a half, however long my films are, if they can capture the attention of someone who then is inspired to have better capacity to support themselves or other people, then as a filmmaker, yeah, it makes me very proud.
That's beautiful. Like it's, as you're saying that, I can't help but think of John Williamson's True Blue, you know, which is so, the line in it, which is about what basically what it means to be Australian, and is it standing by your mate when they're in a fight, right? And that's a beautiful line. And I think that's what it's about, what you do, and it's about what you've spotlighted on screen. I'm getting a little bit teary thinking about it, because it means so much. And I keep on saying that, like, I know I'm like a stuck broken record, but literally when I first watched Happy Sad Man, I'm like, where has this been all my life? You know? And it's a huge thing to be able to have something out there where you've impacted and you've changed people's perspectives and maybe even changed their lives, and being able to, you know, put stuff on screen that makes you feel seen. And that's really what we all want from films. We want to feel seen. And you're doing it in a way which is just so valuable and important. It means a lot. So thank you, Jen, for your time.
Thank you, Andrew. Yeah. I feel like I should share with you something that I haven't mentioned to other people, but I can tell you now that I'm working on a sequel for I'm 11. So I'm very excited about, I can't say yet when it will be finished, because I'm not sure, but I'm really excited to revisit these children now that they're young adults and share their stories with, yeah, you and audiences all over the place who saw the original one. Wait,
that's going to be exciting. Look, it has been in the back of my mind. I'm like, are you going to do it? But I didn't want to be like, is this going to be, you know, Seven Up kind of series? But that's exciting. I'm so thrilled for that. So, yeah. Whenever that comes, I'll be there and happily support it. Thank you.
You know, there was a really special moment in Perth. I'm not sure if I've ever mentioned this to you when I saw you in Perth, but there was a kid who came and saw I'm 11 with his mum in 2012. And afterwards we filmed Vox Pops, and there was queues down the street for people to get into the cinema because it was sold out. It was a really amazing, exciting day. And this mother said in this little post-screening interview, it was like a parenting book written by children. And she said, we drove 3 hours to come here today, crammed all the kids in the car, and that she was like really excited to have made it in. And I met her son and took a photo of him, and she'd written down when I was 11 with the memory. Anyway, fast forward to like 7 years later, when I was back in Perth to screen Happy Sad Man, there was a woman in the foyer at one of our screenings, I think at in Leederville, and I just recognised her voice, and I said, have we met before? And she said, no. And it was before the film was going in, and I said, oh, I don't recognise her face, but I recognise her voice. This is my weird elephant memory. Turns out she was the sister of that woman who had driven 3 hours. And I said, are you sure we haven't met? And she goes, no, but my sister told me to come tonight because she saw your last film. And I said, did she have a son who's wearing a red jumper? And she's like, yeah, she's got a son. So she rings her sister and says, I'm in the foyer with the filmmaker. And her sister says, yeah, that was us. So I said, can he come and see the film tomorrow night? So they came and saw Happy Sad Man the next night. And he's taller than me now. And it was amazing seeing him 7 years on. And he said, oh, well, even if the next film takes 7 years to make, I'll be here. I'll be in Perth at the cinema. And I was like, oh, it's so fun to reconnect with audiences who have seen my work over the years.
Oh, that's huge. Like, gosh. And that's what you want, right? You want to be able to connect and for it to have an impact. And, yeah, to know that 7 years later you've got that still connection and stuff. Oh, that's massive. Well, thank you again for your time. It's always a treat to be able to talk with you and to spend time in your world and getting to see how you see the world. It's a gift. Like, it means a lot. So thank you, Jen. Yeah.
Thank you, Andrew. Thank you for your passion for cinema and for Australian filmmakers. It's a special thing to have people that we know are looking forward to seeing our work. when we're in the edit cave for so many years sometimes, it's nice to, yeah, stick our heads out and realise that the work can be valued by people like yourself. So thank you.
Thanks again for listening to this chat with Jen Bailey about her documentary, Always Listening, which is screening now on SBS On Demand. A link for that will be in the show notes. For other interviews and reviews, visit thecurb.com.au. Please rate, review and share this interview with your film-loving friends. We hope you like it. We hope they like it as much as you have. I'll see you on the next one. Take care of yourselves, everybody.